Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, we're back. Hour three, and the number again, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. If you get a busy signal, just hit redial. Let's go to Jody in Las Vegas. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning.
How are you today?
You have the best show going. Good morning.
You're so nice. Thank you.
I've got a question for you. I was hoping you could help me. Maybe you could compare and contrast between these two types of sins. Okay, so hypothetically speaking, you have an individual that has a disease called Tourette's.
Okay.
And the way that this disease manifests itself is that they have tics. And when they have tics, let's say they have scream out obscenities and they start degrading God, they start doing horrible things or to other people in an offensive way. Then you have another individual who has I don't want to say supposed disease, but I say supposed only because they haven't had the actual clinical diagnostic testing to prove that they have this disease. But the disease is, hypothetically speaking, they have this disease. It's called alcoholism.
Okay.
And so what happens is the way that it manifests itself is that this person gets drunk and sort of does the same type of sin. I was hoping that you could compare and contrast those two types of sins, and that'd be great.
Okay, sure. I'll do my best. So on the one hand, we have somebody who's afflicted with Tourette's. On the other hand, we have somebody who the result of the sin of drunkenness leads to things like Tourette's, the outbursts of profanity and saying hateful things. Do I have that straight?
Correct. And they both have a disease. One has the disease that's called alcoholism. It's sort of understood as being that disease, hasn't really been formally diagnostically diagnosed. They haven't had the genetic testing to show whether or not they sort of just assume, well, I drink a lot and so I'm an alcoholic and I have a disease, but they haven't really ever had the actual genetic testing. But I'm giving them as though they have had the genetic testing.
Right.
So they both have a disease.
They seem to display what you would expect to see in somebody who's been diagnosed clinically, right?
Correct. But for the case of the argument, yes, they do have it. It has been verified clinically and diagnostically in both cases.
Okay. So with now having that kind of clarity, I would say when you talk about compare and contrast, so to compare, there are similar things being done when they have these outbursts and they blaspheme God or they shout profanities or things. In the case of the Tourette's, and I'm not by any means, you know, anything more than just what an average person would know about Tourette's, but I know enough to know that it's beyond that person's control. And so there's no real sin being committed if the person has these outbursts because he can't control it. It's something that is beyond his control. And sin is precisely when you can control what you do or think, and you do something that you know is wrong. So we can exonerate the person who has Tourette's if this person honestly, truly has this and can't control it. This is not a sin that he's doing. It's unfortunate, but it's not a sin. Now, in the case of the person who has alcoholism, and let's just say, as you did for the sake of discussion, that he's been clinically diagnosed. So the similar outcome in terms of bad behavior and saying bad things, but there is an element of sin there for sure if the drinking is something that he consents to. So like any other appetite, if he is saying, I know that when I take a drink, I'm going to turn into this really terrible person, and it's really hard for me to resist taking a drink, but you can resist it. And this is where things like AA come in to help you resist it. But if when he consents to doing something that he knows will lead to these other problems, that's where the sin takes place. Now, once he's under the influence, the things that he does under the influence, you might say, some people might say, well, he's not really responsible for those things because he can't help it, because he's an alcoholic. So he's got this predisposition to black out or to get crazy or to do things like that. Well, not so much. I would propose, and St. Thomas talks about this, how things that you do when you're under the influence of whether it's alcohol or other scenarios, you're still responsible for those things, even if you're not personally choosing to do that thing in the moment because you're blindly drunk. You're still responsible for it. So take, for example, if somebody who's an alcoholic drinks to the point of drunkenness or even less than that and winds up committing a crime of passion like murder. Well, if he, even though he was drunk and even though he has the disease of alcoholism, it doesn't exonerate him from the sin of murder, because the things he did do that he consented to that led up to that means that he's guilty of that as well. Now, his guilt may be mitigated to some extent, but he's still responsible for the things that follow after the drunkenness. Now, I hope that I'm answering your question. Am I getting the point of what you're asking me, or am I missing the point?
Yes, I think you're really doing a great job just elaborating on the two different types. And I would just, it had been proposed to me that, well, a person that has, that I didn't, supposedly I don't understand because I don't understand the disease of alcoholism, that the person cannot control the urges. So the disease is that, you know, they're not really even making the choice to drink. So I mean, cause I have a lot of urges, like sometimes I, you know, if somebody cuts me off in traffic and I'm trying to get somewhere and it's really rude because they don't like to be.
I know what urge you're talking about. I can understand that urge. Yes.
Well, like sometimes it's like, you know, they don't want to be behind a minivan. I get it. But, you know, I got to get somewhere, you know, and I have this urge to where, you know, it's really hard to fight it. And sometimes I do submit to it. And I don't know what, I mean, I guess you could say sin is a disease. I mean, maybe it is. I don't know. But I think you did an excellent job. And I want to thank you for that. And
you're welcome.
I need to learn more about that.
Yeah, well, you know, these are questions, and they're really good questions that you're asking. They're questions that go to the issue of personal culpability in terms of morality or immorality. And how is it that a person can be, you know, objectively guilty of a serious sin, but maybe formally or subjectively the culpability can be reduced? And so the rule of thumb would be if you're talking about let's say a sudden passion that comes on you all of a sudden, anger, let's say, somebody cut you off in traffic and you didn't premeditate this, you didn't think about it, you didn't reflect upon this. It just all of a sudden, this thunderbolt of anger flashes into you because of what somebody did. Well, if you react to that in a way that might be sinful, you know, there are different ways to do it. Your culpability would be much lower than it would be than if you had time to premeditate and to really think about it and to say, well, I'm going to commit this sin. So the Lord understands that we are very often victimized by passion. And passion can be anything that works on you from the outside. Emotions, other people's behavior, alcohol, you're in a place where you see an attractive man and you're like suddenly like really drawn to this man, but he's not your husband. So these are all ways in which passions of various types and appetites of various types can suddenly spring up, you know, and you don't have any chance to prepare for it. And there it is, and you have to deal with it. So all I'm saying is, in the case of somebody who is struggling with those kinds of sudden passions, the Lord understands that even though it may still be a serious sin, the Lord would understand to what extent the person would be culpable of that. But the danger, I think, and maybe this is part of what you're saying, the danger would be to excuse bad behavior by saying, oh, well, he has a disease. He has the disease of alcoholism. Okay, fair enough. And if he does, he does. But it doesn't mean that that somehow excuses taking the drink in the first place, even if he's really mightily struggling with it. And if we want to kind of use a comparison, you talked about compare and contrast. What about somebody who is experiencing strong sexual temptations? I mean, really strong. And it's difficult to say no, because this is a very overpowering appetite that's saying, I want what I want. Well, it's the same kind of thing. It's something that we're called to resist. And St. Paul talks about resisting even to the point of shedding your blood. None of us ever does that. But that's the kind of resistance that we're called to put up so that we don't wind up falling into sin. So,
well, Patrick, I loved the story this morning. You had my teenage daughter giggling away because of you not resisting those cute girls in the guitar.
One in particular. Yeah.
Yeah. That was so funny and great. So have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Jody. And by the way, what brand of coffee do you drink? Because I want to get me some of that. You sound very up this morning.
You know what? I drink this morning. I actually splurged for some Dutch Brothers coffee, which they only have espresso. But I usually get the Bustella, and you've asked me that before.
I think I have.
If I do send you some coffee, do you drink the single pods or do you drink the brewed?
Oh, you're so kind. You don't have to go to all that trouble. But yes, I have a single pod Keurig that I use every morning. Okay. And I have, you know what I like? I like Donut Shop. That to me is the best blend. So that's what I drink in the morning. I'm drinking some right now.
Well,
in my Yeti
maybe
cup.
I'll give you some. I already have some that I've just never sent it to you, but it's Cafe Bustelo. It's espresso style, like coffee, in that you can put in the Keurig, but you can check it out.
Just imagine how much better this show's going to be once I start drinking that. Whatever it is you're drinking, I want some of that.
You're my huckleberry, okay?
All right. Thanks, Jody. And honestly, you don't have to go to any of that trouble, but it's a nice thought, and I appreciate it. Let's go to Peggy now in Marshall, Wisconsin. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning. I have a quick question about the gospel this morning. John 10:31, where Jesus is talking to the Jews, but he references Psalm 82 when he says, is it not written in your law, quote, I said you are God's,
Right.
I was just wondering what he means there, and is that possibly where the Mormons have taken their belief that they become
it
gods?
Is. Yeah, it is. It's one of the verses that they will quote. In their doctrine of eternal progression, which is they believe that they can become gods by nature, or that they also believe that God evolved into becoming a god. So what does this mean? Well, it doesn't mean God by nature, and one way to demonstrate that is to go to the book of Isaiah. Let's go back to Isaiah, and let's just start reading in chapter 40. So verse 18, to whom can you liken God? With what equal can you confront him? Verse 25, to whom can you liken me as an equal, says the Holy One? Verse 28, do you not know or have you not heard the Lord is the eternal God, creator of the ends of the earth? He does not faint or grow weary, and his knowledge is beyond scrutiny. And on it goes in these sections of the book of Isaiah, God talking about how he alone is God. There is no other God but him. And so these are some examples of passages where you can see that by nature there is only one God. So what do we do with these passages that talk about, you know, were you not called gods? So in John chapter 10:34, Jesus is responding to them about using scripture to say, is it not written in your law that you are gods? Now, that term was used of the judges of Israel in the Old Testament. It was a title that they were given. And it sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? Because when you think about it, why would that be a title that would be given to the judges of Israel? But it was. So Jesus is referring to that. He's not saying that you are actually going to become gods. He's making a point here because they are denying or they're questioning him claiming to be God himself. And so because the people are objecting to this and they want to stone him for blasphemy, And yet, so he's reminding them, well, okay. But I mean, even in scripture, it talks about this office of judge as being known as a god, you know, having the status, not as a god, but like issuing decrees and judgments and things the way God would. In a way, kind of like how we call priest father. You know, he's not literally your father, but he's operating in a way like St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where he says, though you may have many guides to Christ, yet you do not have many fathers, for I became your father in Christ Jesus through the gospel. So he's using this term of address, father, in a way that Jesus is referring to it in John chapter 10. And that's what he's saying. He's not saying that they are gods or that they will become gods.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I know I referenced Psalm 82, and there it talks about being sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was just kind of wondering, mm-hmm. you know, that's where the Mormons kind of take off on.
Well, it's one passage
that
they...
Unfortunately, one of my brothers left.
Oh, did he go into Mormonism?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This might be helpful to you, Peggy, or him too. I've written a number of articles to help Catholics and Mormons be more, you know, effective in talking to each other. And I do have an article on the nature of God according to Mormonism and how Catholics can speak intelligently with Mormons. So that's available along with a number of other articles on the topic of Mormonism. It's available for free if you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on articles, and you'll find them all there. And maybe you can share them with him. Or at the very least, if you read them for yourself, it'll give you more, you know, intellectual preparation for the next time you talk with him.
Okay. Sounds wonderful.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm glad I could be of service. We'll take a break and we'll come right back to your phone calls right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutaback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
We're back. Let's go to Maddie now in Minneapolis. Good morning, Maddie.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi.
Hi. So I have a question, and I might play like devil's advocate because this is what my husband does about NFP.
Okay.
And trying to figure out how to explain this for him.
Okay.
So we practice NFP, and he's on board, but he doesn't fully necessarily understand it, but he does it like to respect what I want. But he argues that, you know, at this point we're abstaining from having children because I'm in graduate school, but he argues that like only doing the marital act during the infertile window, how is that any different than contraception? Because we can be so sure with NFP, or like it claims to be 98-99% effective,
mm-hmm.
that how is this any different than contraception? And I try and explain, you know, we're working in accord with how God made a female body, like we're using our natural times of infertility. Mm-hmm. Then he tries to argue back, if God gave us times of infertility that we can be together, then how come we can't use contraception or take part in different acts that wouldn't end in like the normal, natural way?
Right. Yeah, those are common questions. So, for the sake of people listening, I'll say two things. First of all, number one, this is not a topic for children. So please, parents, exercise prudence. And if you have children in the room, either turn the radio down for 4 or 5 minutes or send them away so that they won't hear the conversation because it's not appropriate for them. That's the first thing. So use good judgment, parents, please, for the sake of your kids. Fair warning, ready, steady, go. The other thing is, I'll just define what Maddie's referring to. NFP stands for Natural Family Planning. And she actually just gave a description of it, as you did, Maddie, that in the woman's cycle, there is a window of ovulation in which fertility is possible. And outside of that window, and every woman is different in the way in which women can determine where in the month that window is based on charting and observation of different, there are different methods of doing that. So that's what NFP is for everybody listening and not sure what that means. So back to you, Maddie. You are absolutely correct that it's not at all contraceptive. And the fundamental reason is this, that you are, in the case of contraception, you are, and I don't mean you personally, but the couple, you're enjoying the pleasure of the marital act and all that goes with that, but you are using the pleasure and using the marital act in a way that is not open to life. And so, as you said, Maddie, it could either be using contraception or it could be enjoying that marital intimacy, but having it conclude in a way that would be impossible for life to be present or the transmission of life. And you know what I mean by that, and I know what you mean by that. And married people listening know what you mean by that. So we don't have to describe it. But okay, those are things that are not appropriate, because, and they are sinful, because the primary end of marriage, and specifically the marriage act, is procreation. Now, a close secondary end or purpose of it is the pleasure and the friendship and the intimacy of the husband and the wife, and God ordained it to be so. But if we pull those two apart, those two aspects of the marriage act, and make it all about one or the other, then it's a distortion. So it could either be pure hedonism, which is pleasure for the sake of pleasure, or it could be breeding, which would be, you know, wrong in itself if it was divorced from love and responsibility between the spouses. And an analogy that I have found helpful might be useful for you in talking about this with your husband, but to compare it with fasting from food. Now, we obviously, the primary end or goal of eating food is to stay alive. The secondary end or goal of food is the pleasure that we derive from it. So it, how it looks and how it tastes and all of the things that go into a nice meal. We probably would all be super skinny, and many people might not even be here if food had no taste at all. It would just be so bland that we would eat just to stay alive. So I'm glad that God created food in a way that we can enjoy it as well as stay alive. And when you fast from food, you notice what's happening is you're not enjoying it. You're not using it in a bad way. You're just abstaining from it, as you said. So you're not doing anything wrong. You're not misusing a good thing. But the counterpart to contraception, or one of those acts that we are alluding to here, would be like eating food and, you know, just eating till you're as full as you can be. Then you go to the other room and you barf it all back up. And then you go back to the table and have more, because you don't have to worry about the calories. You barfed all that up. You don't have to worry about any heart or health conditions as a result of too much food. So it's just pure food, pure pleasure for the sake of it. And we call that an eating disorder. And people can even be hospitalized if it gets out of control, because it can really harm them or even kill them. So I see a close parallel between the two. So when you're practicing NFP, you're just simply refraining from using the good of marriage. And when you're fasting from food, you're refraining from using the good of food. But if you were to contracept, you're using the good, but in a wrong way, because you're making it impossible for life to be possible, transmission of life. In the same way that if you're eating food purely for the pleasure, you're removing the responsibility that comes from things like calories and et cetera. So I think that parallel, for many people at least, it's helpful. It comes down to using the good thing the wrong way, or just not using it at all.
Yeah, and I understand that, and I try and explain that part. But then his counter to that argument is usually, you know, if you're in the infertile period and you know for certainty, he goes, are you really open to life? Because then, you know, NFP likes to advertise, you know, 95 or higher percent mm-hmm. effective if used appropriately. And then he goes, are you really open to life? Like, are we really
And here's practicing? The answer. Yeah, here's the answer. The answer is yes. You're open to life if you're not using a condom or a pill or surgery or some act that would, you know, prevent life from being possible. That's what the church is saying to us, is just be open to life, because God could bless you with a child even during your infertile period. The likelihood of it is very low. Could happen, though. So the question of, are you open to life? The answer is yes. If the husband and the wife are engaging in the marital act in a completely natural way with nothing involved that could possibly prevent the transmission of life, that's the definition of being open to life. And that's all the church is saying, is just be open and to enjoy this good of marriage in the natural, normal way, so that you can cooperate with your bodily cycle and at the same time still be open to life if that's God's will for you.
Okay, I guess I understand, but sometimes his mm-hmm. argument is just, if you know that you're infertile and you're only using those days, isn't it just, I guess, I understand in the sense mm-hmm. you're using your body in accordance with what God said and you're just taking part and not taking part at mm-hmm. different times, but I guess I understand, but to play devil's advocate, someone
yeah, go ahead.
Birth control and it has a 98% effective rate, they're still 2% open to life. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes he makes that mm-hmm. argument, not that he wants us to use that, but he says that still has that percentage, so you're technically still open to life a little bit, which...
Mm-hmm. But the thing, maybe this is the part that he's missing, is that by doing something that itself is intrinsically intending to prevent the possibility of life, it doesn't matter what the percentage is. It doesn't matter, is it 1%, is it 10%, is it 3%? The point of the contraception or the action or the pill or, you know, what have you, the whole point is to do everything possible to prevent the possibility of the transmission of life. In the case of NFP, the couple is simply not doing anything that could prevent that and enjoying the benefit of marriage and the marital act in a way that conforms with God's plan. In other words, it's still open to life. The percentages really don't matter one way or the other, you know, however high or low they may be.
In a way, aren't they preventing life by not taking part in the, not taking part in...
Oh, I see. Abstaining?
Like, sorry, are they in a way, preventing life by abstaining mm-hmm. during the fertile window?
Well, if you want to say preventing life, I suppose you could say that. It is for the purpose, I think most couples practice NFP for the purpose of avoiding conception. So yeah, there is a motive behind that for practicing NFP. Otherwise, who would practice it? Why would you practice it if that wasn't the motive? I can see that very clearly. So in this case, if you're saying, Lord, at this moment, given health or finances or war or natural disasters or what have you, I've already got 3 or 4 kids, I need a bit of a breather. Those are valid reasons for not wanting to have another child. And so there's nothing evil, inherently evil, about a couple saying, right now, under these circumstances, we don't want to have another child. They're not committing a sin by having that view. They can commit a sin by how they go about trying to avoid it, but NFP is certainly not a sin, and it's not even equivalent to using contraception or some other means. So honestly, Maddie, it's been, and I don't say this to you, but I've always puzzled over why some people get hung up on this issue. And I'm not talking about you, but it's never made sense to me that people can't see the obvious difference between contraception and NFP. And I've heard all those arguments many times over, and I know you're just playing devil's advocate, so I'm not trying to pin that on you. But
no, that's okay. I actually made the same argument to my husband. I said, I don't know how you don't see the difference of working.
Yeah.
One's working with my body, one's working in direct opposition. And if God, you know, ordained an infertile period, that's obviously what he, I don't know, mm-hmm. allows for us to take part in. But I guess more sometimes he just wonders how, why also we can't separate, like, at some points, like, I understand that it could be fall in the line of hedonism or, like, just breeding, but he, I guess, sometimes said who determined why it always has to be both.
Yeah, I have a feeling, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but I wonder if sometimes when people are I don't know, advocating for that it could be that it could open a door for marital intimacy that doesn't conclude in the way that it's supposed to, and looking for a way in which that could be permitted. If we can make the case that, well, you know, if that's all that really matters is how that finishes, then is there a way around it? Now, I don't know. I mean, I've talked to so many people on this topic, but I sometimes wonder. But in any case, you're right. And maybe you can relate to what I'm saying, that I don't understand why people can't see it. It seems so clear and obvious to me. But these are important topics that, I guess in some cases, they take a lot of time. Have you ever listened to Dr. Janet Smith's digital download? It's a talk called Contraception, Why Not? Have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't.
If you look online, and I don't remember now what her website is, but it might be available there. There's a free downloadable version out there. It's about an hour long, and she gives a lecture on the topic, but she talks about this as well. And I thought it was very helpful and very persuasive when I first heard it 20 years ago. But I'd suggest maybe finding that, and maybe you and your husband listen to it together.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense, sir. We'll have to look into that. I feel like I've used every argument in the books of them, and he just still doesn't fully understand how one... I think you're right with it, what you said about how I think the argumentation is more about trying to justify other acts and seeing why they would not be wrong.
That's my hunch.
Not necessarily contraception. I agree that that's maybe more the puzzling why not, why are those not allowed? Because they can, you know, argument of like, we are husband and wife and can be intimate or bring us closer through that, but...
And there is one particular thing, which we won't talk about on the air, but there is one particular thing that is usually what the husband wants, that if we don't understand the whole idea of the end of marriage or the purpose of the marriage act, and that its primary purpose is to be open to the possibility of the transmission of human life, then it becomes difficult for someone to say, well, if the whole point of it is just marital intimacy, why can't we enjoy that this way? Why does it have to be that way? And if we're seeking to avoid conception, why can't we just do this and not that and have the same result? You know, these are pretty common questions, and I've, you know, I get emails all the time asking about this issue. So the bedrock of the whole thing is, and I probably have to go take a break now, Maddie, but the foundation of everything is that this gift in marriage that the husband and the wife enjoy has a certain responsibility attached to it. And that is the procreation dimension. And when that's eliminated, then this becomes a misuse of this good thing, kind of like eating the food and then barfing it all back up again. It's a misuse of the good thing. But we've already gone down that road. So those are hopefully some things that will be helpful. I don't know. Sounds like you and your husband have had a lot of conversations about it, but maybe this talk by Janet Smith would be helpful.
Yeah, we'll probably replay what we just talked about for him later.
Okay. And I say everything that I've said with all respect to you and your husband and your marriage. And, you know, I'm only here to offer advice, and hopefully this was helpful.
Yes, it was.
I'm glad.
Thank you.
Good chatting with you. We have to take a break, and I'll be back with the rest of the Patrick Madrid Show. Not a whole lot left, but we'll do that right after this quick timeout.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Well, that sure was an interesting conversation and probably a useful one for many of you. I hope so anyway. Cynthia just sent me a note. She's listening in Austin, Texas. Hi, Cynthia. She says, regarding using NFP versus using contraception, she says, I heard the question about the husband not understanding using NFP versus contraception. A priest once explained it as if as NFP is not sending an invitation to a baby to come versus contraception, which is sending a disinvitation telling the baby not to come. That's an interesting way of looking at it, Cynthia. I've never heard that before, but it makes sense. Thank you. This note comes in from Amelia. She says, listening to this call, the one I just had with Maddie, she said, has me thinking about a certain intimate act that my husband and I enjoy where he ends somewhere other than in the natural place. We are open to life, but do it for pleasure and not to prevent pregnancy. Is this a sin? Thank you, she says. Yes, it is. It is a sin. And I'm not here to be the sin police, believe me. It's not my place to, you know, to do anything other than just try to convey as best I can the church's teaching on this issue. So I'll do it in a roundabout way because who knows who's listening. The marital intimacy that you and your husband enjoy, you have a right to it. This is something God intended for you to enjoy, and the pleasure is certainly part of it. But it has to be within the boundaries of the act being completed in the natural way so that it is possible for the transmission of life. Ergo, therefore, any other way, and I know what you're referring to, and married people listening right now know what you're referring to. So that would be an example of enjoying the pleasure of what sort of kind of is like the marriage act, but not really, because it doesn't complete in the proper way. That is a serious sin. So if it's whatever the permutation might be, just remember that that is. Now, if you and your husband didn't know, or maybe you wondered about it, the best thing to do is, number one, stop doing that, and then bring it to confession. And even if the priest says, well, that's not a sin, it is. And you can go to the catechism where it talks all about this. If you want a really dramatic version of this, read Genesis chapter 38. There was a dude by the name of Onan, O-N-A-N, and he did that. He didn't do maybe necessarily exactly what you're referring to, but he did basically the same kind of thing, and God struck him dead on the spot. So that's a pretty dramatic example of how God says no to that. I'll leave it at that, but I think you get the idea. And thank you, Amelia. And then another note came in. And this is from Ernesto. He says, my wife and I practiced NFP throughout our marriage, and we have three beautiful children. Nothing is certain. God's will be done. That's true. Nothing is certain. Now, maybe God might have blessed you with more children if you weren't practicing NFP for so long. But then again, if you had a reason to do so, God says the couple has a right to say when they think it's a good time to have a child or not. So I'm assuming that that's the case. I appreciate that. Back to the phones. Let's go now to Mary in Florida. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. I'm kind of continuing this conversation.
Sure, that's fine.
As I was listening to the previous caller, I had some questions come up myself.
Sure.
So, one, does it matter? So my husband and I married later in life. We don't have children.
Okay.
And I was actually menopausal already when we got married. I'm kind of wondering, does that have any bearing on things? Because sometimes that causes more pain in that condition. Yeah. And sometimes, I'm kind of wondering about that. And then I'm also wondering about, as far as what the church thinks with the, you know, because sometimes it, you know, the marital act does not end the way it's supposed to, in a way that could produce life.
Right.
And sometimes it's accidental and other times it's not. So I was just
These are important questions. Yeah. So let me start with the second one first. So in the case where things are accidental, what the church says is, okay, Sometimes that may happen, and if it's not intentional, it's not a sin. But everybody has to know themselves and their limitations. So if the couple is enjoying all the precursors to the act, and I think you know what I mean by that, right? The things that are preparatory to the completion of the act, that's all lawful. The couple can enjoy all those things. I mean, within reason. You can't do something that's, you know, itself obviously sinful, like pornography or something like that. But within the bounds of marriage, all those things that are preparatory to the act, you have a right to do that and enjoy that and all of the above. And if an accident happens, the church recognizes, God recognizes that if you didn't intend it, it's not a sin. But where there could be some sin, and you'd have to, you know, each person has to examine his own conscience, would be, is it the case where there's not enough care or precaution taken so that somebody wouldn't go beyond his limits and then wind up with a result like that? So if there's any sense of being, I don't know if reckless is the right word, but, you know, not making sure that you don't go farther than you know you should, that could be where there's a sin because the result would be an accident. I don't know if that's the question. I think that's the question you're asking me. So
that is helpful.
Accidents can happen, but we have to be prudent. Now, the menopausal issue would be, I would put it this way, it has no bearing whatsoever on whether or not the couple can enjoy the marital act. And so menopausal is, from a moral standpoint, irrelevant. From a physiological standpoint, and if pain is involved, this, I think, is the question you're asking, and tell me if I'm wrong, but that doesn't thereby permit the couple to seek alternative ways of marital satisfaction that is not, that doesn't end in the way that it should.
Okay.
Is that the question you're asking?
That's kind of what I thought, but it's hard to find an authority or it written somewhere.
Well, the church's moral teaching on this point is covered in the catechism, and I don't have that open in front of me, but if you have a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, you'll be able to find where it says each and every marital act must be, to be moral and licit, must be completed in the natural fashion, each and every act. So that would preclude other acts of that would lead to that conclusion but are not done in the natural fashion. Those would be not permissible. Those would be illicit.
Right.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate the call. The Catechism is a good go-to source, even for things like this. Let's go now to Juliana in Clear Lake, Minnesota. Hi, Juliana.
Hi, Mr. Madrid. I am a high school senior and a Catholic who's attending an online classical Christian school. It's non-denominational, but most of the people there are Protestant.
Okay.
And I'm doing a senior thesis essay and a defense on the early church fathers and their belief in the real presence.
Wonderful.
And in my, basically my paper, I made a point about the Protestant-like theory, and I believe Joe Heschmeyer, this is in one of Joe Heschmeyer's books, where basically this Protestant theory states that there was no union in the church about the Eucharist and that it was divided into two main camps. And in response to this, one of the people on my panel that looked at my paper said that in the Protestant view, doctrines like the Trinity and the Incarnation took time for the church to work out a better understanding of them, at least from the biblical teachings. And he basically asked me if this was the same about the real presence in the Catholic belief, where the correct interpretation wasn't passed down since the beginning, but where it was instead interpreted and further developed. So my question is, where do we stand on this, like, as Catholics? Like, is there a certain extent we agree with it or disagree with it?
Well, a few things in the time that I have. This sounds like a fascinating topic for you to be writing about, Juliana, so I'm happy to hear that you're doing this. I would recommend, number one, that you get a that you get a book called The Hidden Manna. If you have a pen to jot that down, that would be good. The Hidden Manna. Oh, do you? Okay. Have you read it yet? Because this book traces the development of this doctrine from the time of Jesus and the apostles. And it shows you in the earliest writings of the church that we have what they said and taught. And it was indeed universally recognized that the Eucharist was has the real presence of Christ in it. And it was universally, it was not held that the universe, that the Eucharist was merely a symbol. And so that book will give you down to the penny quotes from the church fathers, the Didache, various other monuments of this teaching. I would definitely go to that book to get those specific things. With regard to the question of how did it develop, well, certainly like the doctrine of the Trinity, in the beginning, the church didn't have those terms. Like, there was no taxonomy, a theological taxonomy, like what we have today. So those things were developed over time. And so you won't see the term Trinity in the first century. You see it emerge in the latter part of the second century, but the doctrine is still there. And so in the same way, you wouldn't see transubstantiation or terms like substance and accidents to describe the Eucharist, but the teaching is there, even though it's using a more simplified language to describe it. The church fathers contain countless examples of this, which is why I think that book will do you a lot of good. Have you also had a chance to read the Beginning Apologetics books by Jim Burnham?
No, I haven't.
I would recommend that as well. So if you look up Beginning Apologetics, there are a series of like workbooks, and they have one that's just on the Eucharist. So it takes into account the biblical and the patristic, that's the church fathers, evidence and testimony on that. And that too would be very helpful. Beginning Apologetics, and just find the volume that's on the Eucharist, and that'll help you too. I'd love to know what kind of a grade you get when you get this turned in. So if you think about it and you'd like to call me back down the road, I'd love to hear about that. Thanks, Juliana. Well, until next time, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.